From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the show, case law shakes things up for county tax foreclosures.
This has the possibility to completely overhaul the way tax foreclosure is done in Michigan, because really the state legislature is going to need to change the law that allowed county treasurers to keep these windfalls.
Also, we'll begin a look into how systemic racism flares up in housing and neighborhoods.
For Detroit, when we look at home ownership and the poverty rate, they go hand in hand. We can't separate the segregation aspect.
And teachers are preparing for the many great unknowns of the coming school year.
There's not one teacher, not one administrator in the state of Michigan that has not been doing this like Rubik's Cube type logistical analyses of all of this.
Those conversations coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Today on the show, sundown towns across Michigan define systemic racism in housing and neighborhoods.
These towns sometimes chased black people out, sometimes had law enforcement simply escort them out. But a lot of times, people were forced out either with violence or with the threat of violence.
That conversation later on the program. But first, late last week, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled on an issue that will have big implications on how counties can collect money on tax foreclosed homes. The court said county treasurers can't collect money from auction of tax foreclosed homes. Here to tell us more is Sarah Swick, a reporter for Michigan Radio who has been following this case. Sarah Swick, welcome back to the program.
Hi there.
So tell us a little bit about this case out of Oakland County that made its way to the state Supreme Court.
Well, this was a case that had to do with tax foreclosure and how much basically that counties can profit off of tax foreclosures when they sell homes, foreclosed homes at auction. Now, it's kind of interesting because this group that brought the lawsuit is called the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they're actually a very libertarian leaning, sort of politically to the right group. So their motivation in doing this was all about private property rights and not so much about, you know, concern over people who are facing tax foreclosure. But basically their argument was that, you know, if a home is foreclosed, you know, you owed so much in taxes, let's say you owed $1,000 in back taxes, and the county sold your home for $10,000 at auction, the county is not entitled to the additional $9,000 above and beyond what you owed. And what this ruling in this case, the Supreme Court agreed with that and said basically that counties cannot keep that extra money, that windfall, so to speak, and they need to refund it to the homeowners.
Does this essentially end tax foreclosure process within counties?
No, it doesn't do that. I should preface that by saying that this has the possibility to completely, potentially overhaul the way tax foreclosure is done in Michigan, because really the state legislature is going to need to change the law that allowed county treasurers to keep these windfalls. But really, counties can still foreclose on homes over delinquent taxes, and they can still sell them at auction. The only thing they can't do is keep that extra profit above and beyond what the homeowner owed in taxes. Now, let me say this, too. It's important to note that this does not totally take away the profit motive for counties to foreclose. And, of course, county treasurers would get upset if they suggested they have any profit motive. But, that's
the reality.
The reality in some counties. But they really make most of the money off of delinquent taxes. You know, when a homeowner is late on taxes, they make the most money off of interest and fees off of those delinquent taxes, not necessarily, you know, auction-related profits. So there's still sort of a profit motive in the system, but this does take away one element of it.
So this is precedent-setting going forward. How about retroactively?
Well, that's sort of the big lingering question right now. So the Supreme Court sent this back to the Oakland County Circuit Court to sort of figure out a remedy here. But it's, you know, the Supreme Court was pretty clear that this was an unjust taking without due compensation to homeowners. So, yeah, it does open up this whole big can of worms of to homeowners and, you know, any property owners that this happened to. Does the county now need to refund the money? And there are also some class action lawsuits going on separately that this Supreme Court ruling gives a big boost to. So counties could potentially be looking at, you know, especially big counties like Wayne and Oakland, at having to refund millions and millions of dollars to former homeowners. And that's obviously not, their budgets are not looking great at this point. So it's, that would be a hardship for them.
Tax foreclosure happens in every county, but it doesn't happen in massive amounts because of just population and density within every county. Who are the counties, or what are the counties that will be most directly affected from a financial perspective about this decision?
Well, Wayne County is the big one because, first of all, it's the most populous county, and it also has seen, particularly in the city of Detroit, the overwhelming amount of tax foreclosures in the state. So Wayne County is really sort of set up to take the biggest hit from this because they've foreclosed on the most homes, especially in Detroit. And, you know, obviously tax foreclosure has become this gigantic issue, even aside from sort of the context of this Supreme Court decision, because, you know, so many people in Detroit have lost their homes to tax foreclosure, and it's created so much blight and so much displacement that it's become sort of its own gigantic social problem in itself. But just in terms of the implications of the Supreme Court rulings, you know, a place like Wayne County stands to be most affected. Now, Oakland County, also being a larger county, could see some effects. And other smaller counties that also look to these funds to sort of boost their budgets could see some impacts as well.
When we talk about Wayne County specifically, first of all, has Eric Sabree, the treasurer there, responded to this decision at all?
Not that I'm aware of. And I have to say specifically that I did not reach out to him specifically for comment. I talked to the Oakland County Treasurer, Andy Meisner, who was the actual defendant in this lawsuit. So I, to my knowledge, I don't know that Eric Sabree has said anything about it.
The direction of the overall tax foreclosures has been a positive one. There have been fewer tax foreclosures year over year over the past decade or so. How about going into the future? Do you think that this will at least help stem that tide as well?
I think that's a really big open question. I think that all depends on, since now presumably the state legislature is going to have to go back and at least tweak the state law to, you know, make clear that counties cannot keep these extra auction profits. What else are they going to do? Are they really going to take a hard look at that system that's created so much, you know, hardship and fallout, especially in Wayne County and especially in Detroit? Or are they just going to sort of tweak the law and leave it as it is, you know, for the rest of whatever, you know, the chips fall where they may otherwise? I don't really know. And I think that that's sort of the big question at this point. But it certainly opens up an avenue for wider systemic change here, but whether that will happen is remains to be seen.
You mentioned Andy Meisner, who is the treasurer in Oakland County, and now he's running for Oakland County executive against Dave Coulter in a primary to essentially follow in the long-term legacy after the passing of L. Brooks Patterson. Is this politics there? Is this issue something that is of political interest or concern in Oakland County?
Well, it's certainly become one. I mean, I think the statement that county commissioners put out after the Supreme Court ruling saying, well, it's been clear that Andy Meisner has violated the constitutional rights of homeowners, and now his actions have put the county at risk of losing millions of dollars. I mean, it's somewhat disingenuous because they knew all along exactly what was going on here. And, you know, to my knowledge, I don't know that anyone has said that Andy Meisner acted illegally. You know, he was acting within the bounds of the law like other county treasurers. Now, Oakland County did aggressively defend this case all the way to the Supreme Court. So I guess some people take issue with that. But Meisner says he was obligated to defend the county's position there. But I think it has some not so great political implications for him at this point because it doesn't look good. And going into this race with Dave Coulter, I think it's bad timing for Andy Meisner. Let's just say that.
Is it something that you think will become an issue between now and the primary, or will maintain being an issue over the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how much exactly, but I mean, clearly, you know, some people on commission who support Coulter sort of took this opportunity, let's say, to attack Andy Meisner. I'm not trying to defend Andy Meisner here. I'm just saying that, you know, this was the state law. It allowed county treasurers to do this. So Now they have to go back and they have to fix the law. So, but, you know, I don't think it's not a good thing, let's say, to happen for Andy Meisner right now.
So what happens next? Must there be legislative action to correct for this, how counties can accrue this money?
Well, presumably, that's what everybody's saying, that the state legislature is going to have to take some action. Like I said before, there are these other class action lawsuits that are going on in other courts and federal courts that this ruling gives a huge boost to in terms of homeowners who are actually looking to retroactively collect what, you know, the county took in profits. And then it was sent back to the Oakland County Circuit Court to hash out all of these details here. So there's a lot still going on here, but I think it's important to realize that this is actually a really big deal, and that this ruling does sort of fundamentally change things in terms of tax foreclosure in Michigan, but how much and in what direction, we don't really know yet.
Sarah Swick is a reporter with Michigan Radio and has been following this story. Thanks so much, Sarah.
It's my pleasure.
After more than 30 years in prison, white boy Rick is a free man. Richard Wershe Jr. was freed today from a Florida halfway house and will serve just over a year of parole in his home state of Michigan. If you don't know the nitty-gritty of his case, Wershe, now commonly referred to as White Boy Rick, was brought to national attention as the subject of a recent Matthew McConaughey movie. Rick was serving the longest sentence for a nonviolent crime committed by a juvenile offender in Michigan history. The then teenager was convicted on drug charges that tied him to a life of crime as a drug kingpin. But Wershe maintained the life that he led was in part guided by his role as an FBI informant. Here's Rick talking to WXYT in Detroit from prison in 2012.
I sold drugs for 11 months after I quit working for them. Up until then, everything I did was at the direction of the Detroit Police Department or the FBI. I mean, my whole adult life's been spent in prison. You know, it's hard to imagine. I never thought that I would still be sitting here 25 years later talking to you.
Richard Wershe Jr. was arrested in 1987 at 17 years old. He is now 51 years old. Coming up, parents of school-aged children are waiting anxiously to see if school will open for in-person learning this fall. But many teachers are questioning if it's possible to do that safely.
So much of what we do is just going to be a logistical nightmare trying to get these kids through the hallways. They move through the hallways, depending on schedules, 4 to 5, 6 times a day.
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Heaven help us, the school year is just a few weeks away. And if you're anything like me, you feel like you are woefully out of the loop on what the school year is going to look like for your kids amid a global pandemic. Well, you're not alone. Not that this will make you feel any better, though, but many teachers don't know what learning will look like either, and they're just as worried as you are. Here to talk about what they do know and what teachers are considering going into the fall is Matinga Ragatz, an education consultant and frequent contributor on Stateside. Matinga, welcome.
Thank you, Laura.
Also joining us, Rick Joseph. He's with Birmingham Covington School. He teaches 5th grade and 6th grade, language arts and social studies. Rick, welcome.
Hi, Laura. It's great to be with you.
And Kara Lougheed. She's an English and history teacher at Stony Creek High School in Rochester Hills. Kara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Matinga, I was riding bikes with my family over the weekend. We drove up to the elementary school where my daughter is slated to start kindergarten. And I noticed a series of red X's spaced out conspicuously at 6 feet apart, leading up to basically each of the doors, each of the entrances to each of the classrooms. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, here it comes. This is the beginning of schools really planning what it's going to take logistically to get kids into the classroom. What are you hearing from teachers and administrators about the summer planning process for the great unknown?
Yeah, the great unknown is right. Now, one thing, her being in kindergarten, she just will not know any different. So it was actually be just as exciting and just as fun for her because she won't know what life used to be like. But, you know, I work nationally, so there's a wide spectrum of what's happening, you know, based on what's happening on the ground. Administrators are making decisions based on, like, their resources, the access to personnel, logistical variables. And I can tell you, there's not one teacher, not one administrator in the state of Michigan that has not been doing this like Rubik's Cube type logistical analyses of all of this. So you know that when they open the doors, they are going to be safe. They're going to be okay, in a sense.
Kara, let's talk, Kara and Rick, let's talk a little bit about what this looks like that could be different on an age-to-age basis, grade-to-grade. When I look and I see articles about the potential of outdoor learning and trying to get outside more, where we know it's more safe than being isolated in a classroom with several people, I think to myself, this makes sense for my young kindergartner that she would do really well learning outside. Now, that might not be true for every student, but I also think that would be much more true for a younger child than for, say, a high schooler who has to move around a school by subject. So, Rick, let's start with you. What do you think about what makes most sense for the sort of late elementary, middle school-aged kids?
Well, I think most of the plans, if not all the plans globally, of course, focus on three considerations. One, if there is to be in-person instruction, then in-person instruction needs to take place with mask wearing, physical distancing, and frequent hand washing. So the opportunity to have any kind of instruction outside would certainly be possible. There are things that we can do in an outdoor space that would approximate what we could do in the classroom. There certainly would be some limitations, but it is definitely an option.
And Kara, how about at the high school level? It seems like there is going to be a logistical nightmare, no matter what you're talking about, whether it's transportation or trying to keep first graders wearing masks all day long. But in high school, you're talking about kids generally are moving around all day anyway, and they're not outside for recess. They're very much focused in on studies. So what are the issues that are being discussed at the high school level in Rochester Hills?
So being outside, it kind of makes me chuckle because when I take my seniors out for reading time, sometimes they like it if it's not too hot, not too cold, not too windy, not, you know, so it's like, it's a whole different world and they do move hour to hour. But just the way that high schools, especially high schools in Oakland County, which is where Rochester is, they are overfilled. Like, they are crowded to max capacity. I think Lake Orion has well over 2,000 students in the school. And so to talk about how to space them, how to move them, where to put them to keep them safe, sure, going outside for a few classes when you can is a nice idea. But like you said, so much of what we do is just going to be a logistical nightmare trying to get these kids through the hallways. They move through the hallways, depending on schedules, 4 to 5, 6 times a day. And I don't know if you've been in a high school during passing time recently. I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
It's crowded.
Packed to the gills. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm hearing all kinds of plans, but I was talking to Matinga the other day and a lot of it just feels like nonsense. I just don't know how it would work.
I'm going to ask both Kara and Rick the same question, which is, with just a few weeks really remaining until school starts, do you feel like teachers are prepared for come what may? Kara first.
No. Every group that I am in, every group chat, every Facebook page, on my Twitter feed, no. I mean, they're not prepared to go back to fully full classrooms. I teach U.S. history, and I routinely have anywhere from 32 to 38 students in my classroom. And right now there's not a plan to reduce that number other than offering a virtual option. So that potentially could, if some students chose to stay home. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do going back with full classrooms, full hallways. there's a lot of talk out there about teachers being reluctant to go back. But what I think a lot of people in the public don't realize is that it's not that we're nervous to go back just because of this virus. We're nervous to go back because history has shown us that when schools can't afford something or can't provide something, that falls on teachers and other school staff. And so if you want us to go back, I think we need to feel safe, and no one is feeling like they're going to be safe. That's been my perception. I'll let Rick kind of pick up there.
Yeah, Rick Joseph from Birmingham Covington School.
Laura, to answer your question, I wouldn't say there's a teacher in this country that feels comfortable going back to school in the fall because of all the things that Kara mentioned, of course, and the fact that not only are there so many unknowns and so many variables, even our plans articulate three considerations. One, we go back with masks, physical distancing, and frequent hand washing. Two, we go back in a hybrid setting that combines in-person instruction with online learning. Or three, exclusive online learning. And as Kara said, districts' plans that I've seen basically give parents the choice. And when we've taken surveys of not only the parent population, but the teacher population and said, okay, how many of you feel comfortable going back 100% in-person instruction? How many would like to do a hybrid, and how many want to stay at home? And the numbers that I've seen hover maybe around 50%, 20 to 50% of parents say they want their kid to be virtual. Now, all of that can change depending on the behavior of the virus. And if you look at the numbers in Oakland County, we're into a second wave. So we don't know what's going to happen in a week, a month, 2 months. So no, nobody feels like we're at all comfortable going back to school, because not only are the plans uncertain and how they would work in real life, there are so many variables there, but the virus itself is constantly evolving and changing. So we have never faced a situation that has so many unknowns, so many variables. So it's a time of incredible uncertainty.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rick Joseph and Kara Lougheed. They are teachers considering what's going to happen this fall amid COVID. We've also been speaking with Matinga Ragatz, an education consultant who frequently joins us on this program. Matinga Ragatz, you know, I can't help but think that this is going to require, no matter what where we start the school year, it's going to require teachers, administrators, and districts as a whole being, and parents and kids, of course, in that mix as well, being extremely nimble as the year progresses. We can't just start with one set of ideas and expect that that's where we're going to end the school year as well. Is that where you would say that everybody's got to be mentally, that we have to be nimble and pivot throughout the year to whatever is going to work that month or that week?
For sure. You know, as a community, I think we need to really ask ourselves what the purpose of school is. So right now, we as educators know that the learning environment not only provides that, you know, safety net for the child's mental health, the correct learning environment, but it also induces learning. So now just taking the kids and putting them in a building is not learning. So this idea that, man, if you just kind of take them to school so they can learn, or they're going to be behind if they're not in school, is just nonsensical in my opinion. So the community really needs to understand that we are, and like Rick said, this is an emergency. This is almost like we're at war with this virus. So the first thing we need to do is make sure our communities and our kids are safe, and then worry about their academic development. So their physical development and their mental development is very important, but their academic development needs to take a back seat right now so that we can get this done and done well.
There is this perhaps defeatist sort of vibe out there among some parents, and I'm curious how this might spread to educators as well, that maybe we should be considering this nearly a lost year for most kids, and that just getting through is going to be as much success as we can hope for, and advancing children in their learning is maybe not a realistic expectation. Matinga, do you think that that is overly glass half empty on this one?
I agree with the parents, and I agree with the with the notion that this is not a lost year, because there's a lot of learning opportunities in the lost and during a pandemic, but it is definitely not normal, and it's not business as usual. So as a community of educators, we understand that this is an opportunity for us to pivot the entire education system. This is an opportunity to really understand disparities, equity, and especially what exactly our purpose is in schools. And I think that this culture of always asking teachers to fix the social issues has made us, it's made it really difficult for us to stay on script. And so a lot of us find it really easy to lose the plot. And suddenly you're asking the schools to feed the children, to take care of their mental health, when really we're not set up for that. And like Kara said so eloquently, we don't have the funding for that. And I can tell you, I'm an educator, but I'm not a psychologist. So to ask me to take care of your child's mental health is goes above and beyond my training.
Mm-hmm. Kara Lougheed, when I talk about a lost year or think about a lost year for my kindergartner, it's a lot different than talking about a lost year for a high schooler. Tell me a little bit what weighs on you when you think about the potential of just not making much headway or losing ground with high schoolers.
So I hear what parents are saying, and I have a high schooler myself. I have one going into 10th grade, and then I have one going into 7th grade. And I don't think any year is ever a lost year. I think that there's always opportunities to learn and read and grow and have discussion. What I'm concerned about is that if we go forward with plans to keep class sizes where they are, that's my concern, because these kids are going to need more connection, because we might see them fewer days. If you go into a hybrid model where maybe you only have half the kids a couple of days, to me, that actually presents some really good opportunities to get to know a smaller group of kids. Because what happens is when I have 36 in a room for 1 hour a day, I get to know as many of them as I can. And I know all of their names, and I know I'm trying to know at least something interesting about each one of them. But that's, you know, five times a day. So that's a lot of kids. And if we're in a global pandemic and they already have anxiety and they're already fearful and they have all these classes on top of that. If I had a smaller group a couple days and then I connected with them online on other days, I just feel like that would be one way to mitigate some of this, is if we were allowed to really connect with kids in a little bit smaller groups, and maybe we can just move through the things that are most important to learn. We do things in school sometimes. We have, like, I guess they call them like power standards, and you can pick and choose some things that are really important for kids to learn. And then it's not a lost year. Maybe you didn't get to do as many things as you wanted to, but there's still room for growth in high school. And I think kids would be even more hungry for it if they were given an opportunity to really connect with their teachers in a smaller, more intimate setting.
Rick Joseph, before we wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about the idea of the different ways that students might learn. There's an idea out there floating around that if you are able in any way to keep your children home, perhaps the best thing to do as a parent is to make the decision your child will learn from home, virtually or homeschooling, and give the opportunity to kids who have parents who are essential workers or have the greatest needs to be in a classroom setting, give those kids the advantage that they need by being in the classroom. That raises all sorts of questions about who might be left behind, who would take advantage of those opportunities, and how some kids might advance over others in the classroom. What crosses your mind when you think about the kids who are most vulnerable, who either will or will not be able to take advantage of the classroom setting?
That's a really good question, Laura, because it speaks to the heart of the issue of equity, which is really fundamentally about making sure that kids get what they need. I have had students who, when we were doing virtual learning for the fourth quarter of the school year in the springtime, kids who thrived in an in-person experience floundered at home, and vice versa. Kids who struggled mightily in person were thriving at home. So it's an interesting question. It's a question that really has to be answered on a case-by-case basis and on a family-by-family basis. But it also speaks to what Matinga and Kara have both alluded to in terms of reducing class sizes, in terms of providing the resources that we need. Because if we're going to effectively educate our kids in an equitable manner, we need to have the resources. We need to have the funding. We need to have the personnel. And we need to prioritize education as it stands now. Some schools in Saginaw, Flint, Detroit, Benton Harbor, that's the social service safety net for the entire community. And there's healthcare, there's feeding programs, there's education, but there's so much that a school is. And that's a problem, because that means that there's been a failure of other components of the community when your school is the be all and the end all for the health, the overall health of a group of people. So it depends on the families, but I do think there's that's an important consideration. There certainly has been talk that people with special needs ought to be in an in-person setting, because it's very problematic to learn online. It's incredibly inefficient. It's slow and cumbersome, and not everybody can do it.
That was Rick Joseph. He's a language arts and social studies teacher with Birmingham Covington School, and he's a former teacher of the year, as well as Kara Lougheed. She's an English and history teacher at Stony Creek High School in Rochester Hills, also a former teacher of the year, and Matinga Ragatz. She's an education consultant who joins us frequently to talk about education issues on Stateside. Thank you all for joining us, and, you know, good luck this fall. We're thinking, all of us parents are thinking about all of you teachers, so thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Laura.
Coming up, how segregation in housing shaped neighborhoods across Michigan.
People wanting to be separate from what they perceived was a black city that had danger and crime and all of these problems that they wanted to be no longer associated with. And that's why Metro Detroit looks the way that it does nowadays.
That's after the break. Stick with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Bear. When we talk about what institutional racism looks like, it's generally explained in tangible and intangible ways that aren't codified in law. Well, not anymore, at least. When I looked at the original deed to my first home, a 1950s Cape Cod-style house in Ann Arbor that flew up with others just like it after the war, I was horrified to see that it was written right there, in plain language, that the home was never to be sold to a black family. That's no longer enforceable by law, but it's a grave reminder that what's often unspoken segregation now was made explicit just a few decades ago. Bridge Detroit recently wrote about local-level housing segregation in a piece titled "Detroit Suburbs Grapple with the History of Being Anti-Black Sundown Towns." Bryce Huffman was the reporter on that story and a former Michigan radio reporter. Welcome back to Stateside, Bryce.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So let's talk about what a sundown town is. Explain that term.
Yeah, so a sundown town, generally speaking, is just a municipality where after sundown, black people were not allowed to be there. The reason that it's after sundown is because many of these towns let black people work there, mostly in service roles, being housemaids, being butlers, things like that for rich people. But they weren't allowed to own homes there. So the implication was if they were there after sundown, that means they probably lived there. So these towns sometimes chased black people out, sometimes had law enforcement simply escort them out. But a lot of times people were forced out either with violence or with the threat of violence.
Was it made explicit in law, or was it something that was enforced sort of off the books?
In certain suburbs, it was actually part of law. And the way that they did this wasn't the same in every suburb. Some suburbs had laws on the books saying that if a black person was across their border after dark, law enforcement was not going to protect that person. So any trouble that came their way, they would have to deal with alone. Other suburbs had it in housing contracts and in neighborhood association contracts where they weren't allowing black people to live there or own homes there, even though at the time, especially after World War II, a lot of black families could actually afford to own homes in these neighborhoods.
Right. So not dissimilar to what I saw on my deed that would have just been very common.
That was average, you know. Yeah. That was very normal to have housing deeds. And people still buy homes to this day where in the deed it says you're not allowed to sell to a black person. I actually have cousins in Detroit who on the east side of Detroit had a home where that was part of the deed. It was they're not allowed to sell this home to black people. And obviously a lot of people who would go on to buy and then resell these homes didn't pay any attention to that. That was definitely something that was in writing.
So when did these series of policy maneuvers become unenforceable? I imagine it was sort of a game of inches as well, making these unenforceable by law.
Yeah. So what we really started to see was in the 70s, a lot of these rules were no longer kind of on the books per se. They were just part of the public perception, right? So a place like Livonia didn't have any laws on the books restricting black people from living there after, you know, the 60s and 70s. But people knew the reputation. People avoided it because of the reputation. And white homeowners there often subtly and sometimes not so subtly tried to enforce it on their own.
You reference in your story a researcher who listed all of Michigan's sundown towns that he could find, and they're all over the map in Michigan. Kalamazoo, East Lansing, Birmingham, Bad Axe, I mean, just throughout the entire state. But it's really not that hard to notice that many of them are concentrated around the city of Detroit itself. How did the relationship get this way explicitly in Southeast Michigan?
Yeah, that is actually a really good point. A lot of the places that had these strict rules were concentrated in Metro Detroit because, as is still the case, many of the state's African-American population is centered in Metro Detroit. So the reason that a lot of them wanted to have rules on the books was because they wanted to stay all white. And with the city of Detroit having factories and places where black people were working and earning money, to them, the threat of having black people invade their neighborhoods was a lot realer than in other parts of the state, where there weren't a high concentration of black people working and living there.
You talk about Livonia in your story because of a controversial billboard that went up recently. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So the billboard says, "Driving while black, racial profiling ahead, welcome to Livonia." And when I first saw it, I thought, wow, people in Livonia probably won't be too happy to see that. So I think what this billboard is really trying to get people to wake up to is that implicit bias and racial profiling still exist. These are not things that are new, but these are things that we need to reckon with, especially if you are in Livonia and you want your neighborhood to be more diverse, or if you think diversity matters for your neighborhood and community. These are discussions that need to be had. So when the group put up the billboard, that was their full intention, was to have the conversation that a lot of people might not be ready to have.
Yeah, sundown towns. You know, that's a phrase that I did not grow up with and wasn't familiar with me in my white family. And that's not something we ever really discussed or I had any knowledge of until I started working with my former colleague and your current editor, Stephen Henderson. And in discussions with him, that's the first time I ever really remember hearing about this idea that you couldn't be somewhere after sundown. When you're talking with family and friends and sources today, and your story has a lot of historical context, but when you're talking today, are there still communities that folks feel like they should not be in or around after sundown? And what would be that perceived threat if not the police escorting people out anymore?
I think what happens nowadays is we as black kids and teenagers, we're getting to a point where we're exploring more of the area around us. You know, we're starting to drive, we're starting to hang out with friends who might not live so close to us or in our neighborhoods. And family members who remember what it was like when they literally weren't allowed in these places after dark, they want to warn us. They want to keep us safe. So when we hear stories about, you know, police in other communities pulling over black drivers and shooting them for minor traffic offenses, our family members and our elders and people who know the history here, they want to prevent us from being another headline. So a lot of the time, the conversations when you're driving for the first time, when you're 16 and you get your license, you know, for a lot of kids I went to high school with, the conversation was as simple as, you know, make sure you wear your seatbelt and don't have too many friends in the car. For me and my black friends, it was, you know, really be careful when you cross 8 Mile because the cops might not be as friendly as the ones here in Detroit.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bryce Huffman. He's a reporter at Bridge Detroit. You may, however, know him from his days as a West Michigan reporter here on Michigan Radio and the host of Same, Same, Different podcast. I want to talk a little bit more about housing again with you, Bryce, and how that plays into the sundown town aspect of how we view community. Let's talk about access to capital specifically and how the lending system and the deeds that were on homes shaped where people could live in any of these communities we're talking about.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up because I think that is a piece of the segregation, not only in Michigan or not even in Metro Detroit, but around the country that people don't really talk about much. The Federal Housing Administration really did commit a sin that they haven't ever reckoned with when it comes to segregation. The lending policies themselves were actually just plain racist. They made mortgage loans that were affordable available to white people, and they could buy homes in these newly started up suburbs, while black families were almost entirely excluded from that opportunity. And this occurred even in times when black people could afford to pay double what their white counterparts could. And then, of course, we all know about the practice of redlining, which excluded certain neighborhoods from not just loans, but from government assistance and from federal programs that would help these neighborhoods do better in the decades to come. So when we look at just, you know, the loan practice alone, we see that black people weren't allowed to build up capital the same way as white Americans. And when people ask me now, you know, Bryce, why is it that all these major cities in every part of the country seem to have a similar trend when it comes to poor black people living in rundown, rough neighborhoods? You know, I tell them the same thing. It's these neighborhoods were deemed not important by the federal government and therefore didn't receive the money that it would have taken to keep these neighborhoods afloat and prospering the way the government supported white communities.
We've seen reports even in recent years that the bulk of mortgage loans are going in the city of Detroit, which is a majority black city, going to majority white homeowners. And I'm just curious what we know about the ability for black people to access capital today and how that affects that sundown town dynamic in Southeast Michigan.
So I think when we talk specifically about Southeast Michigan and Metro Detroit, the suburbs around the city, a lot of them were built up around the city in a way that they wanted to be all white to begin with. So people knew when they would apply for these loans and when they would build houses and when they would buy houses, they knew that the value of their neighborhood was going to stay up the whiter it was. And that's not an accident. You know, I think for Detroit, when we look at home ownership and the poverty rate, they go hand in hand. We can't separate the segregation aspect, the lending practices, redlining. We can't separate any of that from people wanting to be separate from what they perceived was a black city that had danger and crime and all of these problems that they wanted to be no longer associated with. And that's why Metro Detroit looks the way that it does nowadays.
What is the pretense on which communities can justify or operate around with these kind of sundown stances in a modern America?
I think a lot of it is they dress up the language. They don't want to say they're against having black people move in, because that would immediately become a lawsuit and become a terrible headline. What they say is they want people in their community who can afford to live there, who come from good homes already a lot of the time, and they want to talk about crime a lot of the time. And when you look at a city like Detroit that is majority black, that has a high poverty rate, that is often negatively depicted because of crime, it gives people this false sense that black communities and black people are more likely to be criminal in nature or more dangerous in nature. And, you know, yes, when you look at crime stats, that's part of it, but it's also you have to think about how these neighborhoods have been policed, and how police forces often don't treat white criminals and black criminals the exact same way. So nowadays, when suburbs and different municipalities talk about, well, you know, yeah, we're majority white, but that's not really our fault, and that's not because of racism, it's because of, you know, this factor, that factor, and this other factor, what they're really trying to do is pass the blame down to other factors that, you know, might be partially true, but, you know, these municipalities, they know what goes on. They understand that people in their neighborhoods respond negatively when black people move in. They respond negatively when Latino families move in next door. I was hearing stories from people who didn't want to go on record, but were telling me all sorts of horror stories about having the police called on them while they're walking their dogs in these suburbs. The police called on them when they're picking their kids up from school. And a lot of it comes down to simply, you know, racism, old-fashioned, nothing new about it, all-American racism.
So that kind of gets to the heart of the phenomenon of like a self-segregation and why people, why a black person might decide to live in a black community because they don't want to have the police called on them while they're walking their dog. But we started the story with a woman in Livonia, a black woman in Livonia that you interviewed. Did you talk to her about why she chooses to stay in that community despite the circumstances around her or the lack of other black and brown people who live near her?
Yeah, I talked to her. Her name is Delisha Upshaw, and she has lived in Livonia, I think, for maybe the past 15 or so years. And she said she moved out there for the same reason a lot of people move out there, schools. Detroit has a very troubled history with its public school district. It is continually defunded year after year after year. And that goes to show you that some people will put their child's education over their own safety and comfort. And I think that's the choice a lot of black people in Metro Detroit make. They want to have their kid have the best opportunity for their future. And, you know, sometimes they recognize that sending their kid to a Detroit public school might not be that best option for them.
Do you get the impression that sundown towns, though they have a very steeped history in the area, are going the way of the dinosaur, that they are at least phasing themselves out? Or do you think that they will find a way to exist in some way, whether it's changing the way that it's enforced or not?
I think now it's not a necessarily a quote-unquote sundown town. I think what we have is suburbs who have this perception that's so deep that it will never really go away. And part of it isn't just the perception. It's also the economic reality that, you know, if a suburb is very expensive to live in, thanks to how economics and race are tied up in this country and generating wealth happened in this country, you're already blocking yourself off to having a lot of black people live there. And I think that is how sundown towns, or these former sundown towns, are going to remain. I don't think the Grosse Pointes will ever be majority black. I don't think Livonia will ever be majority black. And I don't necessarily think that that's a horrible thing. I just think that we need to recognize why it won't be that way. And we need to recognize that the people who are living there and benefiting from not having to pay as high property taxes and having better schools and having what a lot of people think are safer communities, a lot of that comes down to race.
Bryce Huffman authored a piece entitled Detroit Suburbs Grapple with the History of Being Anti-Black Sundown Towns. That piece was published in Bridge Detroit, where he is a reporter. Thanks so much, Bryce.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
That's it for today. Tomorrow on the show, we dig into the story of a woman deemed Detroit's other Rosa Parks. Sarah Elizabeth Ray was refused a ride on a Bablo Island ferry in 1945.
Sarah was on the boat with her classmates celebrating when she was asked to leave. And she refused at first. And then her teacher said she'll go quietly.
Her case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court with the assistance of Thurgood Marshall. That story tomorrow on Stateside. Please join us. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.